I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The fact that there have been over 100 foreign military sales to Israel authorized by the State Department since October 7th demonstrates how the Biden administration is just continuing to flow arms and that the Biden administration is not serious when they are talking about putting pressure on Israel, whether for the opening of humanitarian passages or for a ceasefire.
As the Biden administration expresses concern for civilian casualties in Gaza, a new Washington Post investigation finds the White House has flooded Israel with more than 100 separate weapon sales, almost all without congressional approval. We'll speak with former State Department official Josh Paul, who oversaw foreign arms sales but resigned in protest over U.S. support for Israel's assault on Gaza. We'll also get the latest on ceasefire talks that remain at an impasse days before the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins. And we go to Pakistan, where Shahbaz Sharif has been sworn in as prime minister for a second time amidst protests and accusations of election rigging. All that and more coming up. To Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A Gaza ceasefire before the start of Ramadan appears increasingly unlikely after Hamas delegates left Cairo talks without an agreement after accusing Israel of thwarting efforts put forward by mediators. Hamas says negotiations will nonetheless continue. Israel reportedly boycotted the recent talks. The official death toll in Gaza has topped 30,800 in the 5 months since Israel's assault began. At least another 72,000 Palestinians have been wounded. The group Refugees International's warning Israel's persistent blocking of humanitarian aid into Gaza has created apocalyptic conditions inside the besieged territory. At least 20 Gazans have starved to death, the youngest victim a day old. As a number of countries have started conducting airdrops into Gaza, the World Food Program cautioned, airdrops are a last resort and will not avert famine, they said. This is a soup kitchen volunteer in Rafah.
Our hearts are being squeezed when a child comes over and says, I want to have rice and chicken. We are unable to provide rice, let alone chicken, in the light of the war that we are experiencing. This is not only a war on civilians, it is a war on food, on starvation. People here in the Gaza Strip cannot find bread to eat.
South Africa has requested the International Court of Justice take additional emergency measures in Gaza, including ordering a ceasefire. South Africa brought the genocide case against Israel at the ICJ. It said, quote, the threat of all-out famine has now materialized. The court needs to act now to stop the imminent tragedy, unquote. Canada says it will resume funding to UNRWA after it halted support for the UN agency in January following Israeli claims 12 UNRWA staff were involved in the October 7th attacks. 16 countries suspended their funding for the agency, bringing a close to collapse amidst the spiraling humanitarian disaster in Gaza. Meanwhile, a new investigation by the Washington Post reveals the Biden administration has quietly approved over 100 weapon sales to Israel while publicly calling for restraint and decrying the mounting civilian death toll. We'll have more on that story later in the broadcast. U.S. military officials said Wednesday a Houthi missile attack on a commercial ship in the Gulf of Aden killed at least three people. It's the first known deaths as a result of the Houthi campaign against Israel and U.S.-linked vessels. The ship that was attacked appears to have been Barbados-flagged, Greece-operated, and Liberia-owned. U.S. and U.K. forces have launched multiple attacks inside Yemen since the Houthi strike started in protest of Israel's war on Gaza. here in New York. A delegation of Palestinian Americans who've lost relatives to Israeli attacks in Gaza joined UN Palestinian envoy Riyad Mansour at a UN Security Council press conference Wednesday. This is Dr. Rula El-Fadda, who lost over 150 family members since October 7th.
In December, one of our family members, Sabri El-Farra, was murdered in his home by an Israeli airstrike with his 9 young children. His unfortunate wife survived. She was 8 months pregnant. She was displaced to an evacuation camp where she gave birth to her baby boy 1 month later in January. Her child, her newborn infant, died 20 days later from the cold and the harsh conditions in the camps. Every minute signifies the loss of a life, the starvation of a child. And so we need an immediate and permanent, not temporary, permanent ceasefire now.
In Washington, D.C., activists have set up a protest in front of the Israeli embassy. Israeli-American activist Michael Peled says the protest has disrupted embassy business and is calling on more people to join the action until the embassy is forced to shut down.
Palestinian flags have clearly taken over the other flag that's being flown here. The flag of hope is clearly taken over the flag of hate and apartheid. This is the apartheid embassy. And look at all this. Just brilliant, as far as the eye can see.
Michael Peled is the son of a famous Israeli general. In Austin, Texas, at least 5 musical acts have pulled out of the upcoming South by Southwest Festival over its ties to the U.S. military and military contractors, including RTX Corporation, formerly known as Raytheon. RTX supplies weapons to Israel. Outside the United States, Brazil's Central Workers Union, which represents over 7.4 million workers, has called on the Brazilian government to cancel all military cooperation with Israel. In Canada, rights groups are suing the Global Affairs Ministry for exporting military goods and technology to Israel during its assault on Gaza. In Ukraine, a Russian attack on the port city of Odessa killed at least 5 people, according to the Ukrainian Navy. The strike came as President Volodymyr Zelensky was taking the Greek Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, on a tour of the war-ravaged city, where 12 people, including children, were killed in a drone attack last week. The Greek Prime Minister spoke after Wednesday's attack, which the two leaders heard as they were getting into their cars following the tour.
And I think this is one more reason why all European leaders should come to Ukraine, because it is one thing to see, to hear the description from the mass media or from President Zelensky, with whom we regularly communicate, and it is completely different to experience the war firsthand.
In Russia, Yulia Navalnaya, the widow of the late opposition leader Alexei Navalny, is urging voters to protest President Vladimir Putin at the polls in the March 17th election.
We need to use the election day to show that we exist and there are many of us. We are real, we are alive, we exist and we are against Putin. We need to come to the polling station in the same day and time, noon of March 17. It is up to you to choose what to do next. You can vote for any candidate but Putin. You can spoil the ballot. You can write on it in big letters, Navalny.
The Miami Herald is reporting the Biden administration's pressuring Haiti's unelected Prime Minister Ariel Henry to resign amidst an armed uprising against his rule. According to a U.S. document obtained by the Miami Herald, the Biden administration's proposed Henry's, quote, step down in the near future. The State Department pushed back on the report, but the U.N. ambassador, Linda Thomas Greenfield, confirmed the U.S. has asked Henry to form a transitional council that would involve the appointment of a new prime minister. Over the past 3 years, the U.S. has been a key backer of Henry, who's deeply unpopular in Haiti. Last week, Ariel Henry visited Kenya to discuss a plan to send 1,000 international Kenyan police officers to Haiti. Henry is now in Puerto Rico, unable to safely return home. Nikki Haley suspended her presidential campaign Wednesday after losing all but Vermont to Donald Trump on Super Tuesday. Haley declined to endorse Trump or any other candidate as she announced the end of her campaign.
In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that.
President Biden made a pitch to Haley's supporters saying, quote, I know there's a lot we won't agree on, but on the fundamental issues of preserving American democracy, on standing up for the rule of law, on treating each other with decency, dignity and respect, on preserving NATO and standing up to America's adversaries, I hope and believe we can find common ground, Biden said. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who's leaving his leadership post in November, endorsed Donald Trump. In 2021, McConnell said Trump was morally and practically responsible for the January 6th insurrection and called Trump's actions a, quote, disgraceful dereliction of duty. In more related news, the Supreme Court has set April 25th as the date to hear arguments over whether Trump's immune from criminal prosecution for trying to overturn his 2020 election loss. President Biden will deliver his State of the Union address tonight before a joint session of Congress. Biden's expected to call for increasing taxes on billionaires and corporations. First Lady Dr. Jill Biden's guests include United Auto Workers President Sean Fain and the Prime Minister of Sweden. Numerous lawmakers are inviting relatives of hostages held in Gaza. Congressmember Cori Bush is bringing Dr. Intimas Lama, a Palestinian dentist and graduate student from St. Louis University, who's lost 35 relatives in Israel's assault on Gaza. Republican Congressmember Thomas Massie has invited the brother of Julian Assange, the imprisoned WikiLeaks editor who's facing U.S. extradition and, if found guilty in a U.S. court, 175 years in jail he could have to serve. Senator Tim Kaine is bringing Elizabeth Carr, the first woman born by IVF in the United States. And Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson has invited the parents of Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter imprisoned in Russia. Alabama Republican Governor Kay Ivey signed into law a bill protecting in vitro fertilization clinics and doctors from lawsuits and prosecution. Lawmakers scrambled to pass the legislation after Alabama's Supreme Court ruled last month frozen embryos have the same rights as children, sending shockwaves through the medical community. At least three clinics suspended treatments in Alabama in response to the ruling. Two of those said they will now resume treatment. Reproductive rights advocates cautioned the new law does not fully resolve the issue as it does not address whether a frozen embryo can be considered a child. To see our segments on IVF, go to democracynow.org. France became the first country in the world to enshrine the right to abortion in its constitution. Following the 780-72 vote, the Eiffel Tower was lit up with the phrase, "My body, my choice." Abortion has been legal in France since 1975, but lawmakers decided to take the additional step in direct response to the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade in 2022. This is leftist lawmaker Mathilde Panot.
We are celebrating a historic victory. Our vote is a promise made to the future. Never will our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren have to relive the torment that has preceded them. Our vote is also a promise to all women around the world who are fighting for the right to have control over their bodies in Argentina, in the United States, in Andorra, in Italy, in Hungary, in Poland. Like an echo, today's vote tells them that their fight is ours and that this victory is theirs.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul has announced a plan to deploy 1,000 members of the National Guard and state police to patrol New York City subway stations and to check bags of passengers. New York Civil Liberties Union head Donna Lieberman condemned the plan, saying, quote, these heavy-handed approaches will, like stop and frisk, be used to accost and profile black and brown New Yorkers, ripping a page straight out of the Giuliani playbook. Today's announcement fails to address long-standing problems of homelessness, poverty, or access to mental health care, Lieberman said. And in New Mexico, a jury found Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the weapons handler on the film Rust, guilty of involuntary manslaughter for the 2022 killing of cinematographer Helena Hutchins by a loaded prop gun. Jurors agreed that Gutierrez Reed, whose father is a prominent armorer in Hollywood, displayed, quote, willful disregard for the safety of others, unquote. She faces up to 18 months in prison. Alec Baldwin, who fired the gun during a rehearsal, is the star and producer of Rust. He'll face his own manslaughter trial in July. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. A Hamas delegation that was in Cairo for ceasefire talks has left Egypt, accusing Israel of, quote, thwarting efforts to reach a deal. Talks are expected to resume next week. Senior Hamas official Sami Abu Zuhri told Reuters that Israel is insisting on rejecting elements of a deal for a phased process that would culminate in an end to Israel's assault on Gaza, as well as ensuring the entry of aid and facilitating the return of displaced Palestinians back to their homes in Gaza. Negotiators from Hamas, Qatar, and Egypt, but not Israel, were in Cairo trying to secure a 40-day ceasefire in time for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which begins early next week. With the talks at an impasse and only set to resume next week, that unofficial deadline for a deal appears highly unlikely.
On Tuesday, President Biden urged Hamas to accept the terms on the table and claimed that a rational offer had been made for a ceasefire in exchange for the release of Israeli hostages. Biden told reporters, it's in the hands of Hamas right now. If we get to the circumstance that it continues to Ramadan, it's going to be very dangerous, Biden said. As the talks have been underway, Israel's continued its relentless bombardment of Gaza, killing over 80 people in the last 24 hours. The death toll after nearly 5 months of the assault is at least 30,800 killed and nearly 73,000 wounded. Meanwhile, hunger has reached catastrophic levels as a result of Israel's siege. At least 20 Palestinians have died from malnutrition and dehydration, according to the health ministry. For more, we're joined by Tahani Mustafa, senior Palestine analyst at the International Crisis Group. She's normally based in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, but is joining us today from Doha, Qatar, where she's attending a symposium on Palestine organized by Georgetown University. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tahani. Can you start off by talking about the situation on the ground and these ceasefire talks? Hamas is saying that Israel sabotaged the talks, and Hamas has left Cairo, and then we're getting word that actually some negotiations are still underway.
So I think negotiations at the moment are very precarious. We've seen that the ceasefire deal, or at least what is being offered by Israel and the U.S., who, by the way, have unilaterally come up with some of these conditions rather than actually effectively engaged with Hamas. It appears to be a very, politically calculated move so that they can essentially point the blame at Hamas if this fails. But what we've seen in these proposals that have been offered is that they offer very little to both Hamas and Gaza. There is no guarantee in terms of aid, how much aid will be let in. Already Israel is claiming that they are allowing sufficient amounts of aid, contrary to what even human rights organizations are saying. So we've already seen that they are tempering with reality there. And there's also the concern, and rightly so, that this will simply, in terms of what has been offered, is a six-week pause is what Israel and the U.S. is offering. And so for Hamas and for Gazans, they basically see that as a pause in the killing machine, essentially, where Hamas hands over those hostages, surrenders all the cards at its disposal, and then the killing machine just resumes.
Tahani, could you explain why what's remarkable about these talks, one of the things, is that Israel is in fact refused to participate in the talks that were held in Cairo, saying that Hamas must present a list of 40 elderly, sick, and female hostages who would be the first to be released as part of a truce. So could you explain what the obstacles are to revealing such a list and why Hamas is hesitant to do so?
It's not necessarily hesitancy. It's the difficulty in terms of trying to gauge how many hostages are actually alive, especially given that Hamas is not holding all of those hostages. So you know there could very well be hostages being held captive by other groups. Now, given obviously the difficulty in terms of movement due to the Israeli onslaught, it's made it very difficult to gather any concrete numbers, especially in terms of how many of those are actually alive. So it's more the logistics of being able to actually provide a proper confirmed list that's holding Hamas back.
Tahani, what are the risks of an agreement not being reached next week? Because initially there were concerns that Israel would then go ahead with its Rafah invasion.
I mean, look, next week marks the beginning of Ramadan. You know, for the last couple of years now, we've seen that Ramadan has been an incredibly provocative time. May 2021 marked the previous cross-border conflict between Israel and Hamas. And that had nothing to do with events in Gaza and everything to do with provocations we saw in places like East Jerusalem. If we don't see, which we're not most likely going to end up seeing, a ceasefire or some kind of pause before Ramadan, given the escalation of violence, given temperatures on the ground, you know, this could be catastrophic, not just for Gaza in terms of what this also then means about a looming invasion of Rafah, which Israeli analysts are warning is not a matter of if, but when. But also in places like the West Bank and even East Jerusalem, where Israel has so far claimed that it's not going to limit access to places like the Al-Aqsa compound. But we have seen in the past that it has actually done that. And often this has been very arbitrary in terms of the times and conditions that they've put in terms of limitations on access. But more importantly, how that has led, especially in the last 2 years, to severe escalations of violence.
In a next segment, we're going to talk more extensively about this Washington Post expose that says that the U.S. has flooded Israel quietly with about 100 weapons transfers that have not been, most of them, approved by Congress overwhelmingly. Can you talk about the significance of President Biden saying, we must get more aid into Gaza, there are no excuses, none, yet at the same time, the thing that's stopping this, the Israeli bombardment, the stopping of the aid groups, the U.S. has supported when it comes to Gaza, backed up by bombs, missiles and ammunition.
Well, precisely. I mean, that very much nails it on the head, is that the U.S. has done very little in terms of putting any pressure on Israel to limit some of the violence on the ground, limit the intensity of its military campaign. And at the same time, it's now complaining that there aren't any sufficient aid routes. The U.S. has the leverage to ensure that there are sufficient aid routes. The U.S. has the leverage to ensure that Israel abides by the provisional measures set out by the ICJ when it has claimed that Israel has a case to answer for when it comes to genocide. But it simply hasn't done that. There is absolutely no red lines, no pressure being put on Israel. And worse yet, we're seeing things like these sorts of aid drops where even in terms of nutritional value and sufficiency, I mean, they don't even come close to meeting the needs of most Gazans in the north. I mean, it's honestly, I mean, it's more of a kind of posturing of U.S. ineffectual diplomacy more than anything.
You're normally based, let's just, apart from what's going on in Gaza, if you could talk about what the situation in the occupied West Bank has been since October 7th.
I mean, the situation has been incredibly dire, and unfortunately, given all the media attention on Gaza, there hasn't really been much focus in terms of a lot of the violations that have been happening in the West Bank, where we have, in the first month alone, we saw an uptick in Israeli settler violence, where we saw something like 15 Palestinian communities displaced, where we saw the West Bank being put under an economic siege, which has lasted until today, by the way. There have been restrictions on movement, where you've had the PA's administrative capital cut off from the northern part of the West Bank due to the erection of makeshift checkpoints and road closures and roadblocks. Worse yet, you've seen prior to the 7th of October, most of the flashpoints in the West Bank were primarily in the north, in places like Jenin, in Nablus. Now that has pretty much spread across the board. You're seeing places where militancy was not an issue prior to the 7th of October pop up, in places like Tubas, in places like Hebron. Worse yet, you are seeing similar images to where you've seen the destruction of localities in Gaza, where you're now seeing those exact same images, but on a smaller scale in places like Jenin refugee camp, in places like Tulkarm refugee camp, where Israeli soldiers have gone in and razed these localities, these neighborhoods to the ground, where they have destroyed electricity lines, sanitation, water, cultural centers, which used to serve as a form of civic expression and mechanisms for younger Palestinians to vent their frustrations in more peaceful forms, right? But you've seen younger generations now being swayed more towards, out of necessity, militancy and armed resistance, and where these neighborhoods have practically become uninhabitable. So, you know, you've seen a significant uptick in terms of the violence, not just from settlers, but Israeli soldiers. From the 7th of October until now, until today, in the West Bank alone, we've seen something like 420 Palestinians killed, and the majority of those have been through search and arrest operations and targeted assassinations.
One of the reported parts of the ceasefire are hostages released, as well as Palestinian prisoners. Talk about the number of Palestinians who've been arrested just since October 7th, for example, on the occupied West Bank. Is it something like, well, over 7,000? How many of them are children? How many of them are under 18? And what have they been charged with?
Well, the majority of those that have been arrested are something like 7,000. A significant proportion of those are children, you know, people under the age of 18. And in terms of charge, I mean, that's the point. They haven't been charged with anything. This is administrative detention where they can be held indefinitely without charge or trial. And that can range from any kind of activity, whether it's liking a Facebook post or simply expressing any kind of solidarity with Gaza. The Israelis don't really need any legitimate excuse or reasoning to arrest people in the West Bank. These have been very arbitrary arrests, and these arrests can range between 50 to 100 a day, are some of the figures we've seen since the start of the 7th of October. And I think it's worth reminding your viewers that this is on a population that had nothing to do with the events of the 7th of October. The PA president, Mahmoud Abbas, came out immediately after the attacks of the 7th of October and condemned both Hamas and armed resistance, claiming that armed resistance was not a means towards self-determination. And yet we have seen the collective punishment wreaked upon a population that, as I said, had nothing to do with the events of the 7th of October.
And Tahani, could you explain? I mean, there have been a number of Gaza detainees, 27, who've died in custody. If you could explain, you know, how many you know of and who these people are.
Again, these arrests are incredibly arbitrary. You know, they have been effectively arresting men, women, children. We've seen Israeli soldiers quite literally posting the images and videos of themselves torturing and arresting and withholding, again, young men, women, children on social media accounts like Telegram, TikTok, you know, posting a lot of these what amount to effectively war crimes on social media, which really goes to show the level of impunity that Israel knows that it can get away with. And as I said, these arrests have been very arbitrary. These people are often not affiliated to Hamas. In fact, if anything, I think a couple of months ago we saw And this was actually something surprisingly called out by Western media, the way that Israel tried to doctor those images to show that they were militants when in fact they weren't. So many of those that have been arrested are regular Gazan civilians that have absolutely no affiliation to any particular political faction.
I want to ask you about South Africa once again going to the International Court of Justice, asking it to take additional emergency measures in Gaza, including ordering a ceasefire. Of course, South Africa brought the genocide case against Israel before the court, but said the threat of all-out famine has now materialized. The court needs to act now to stop imminent tragedy. Tahani.
I mean, look, I think in practice,